She jerks back in fright, spilling boiling water over her hand and dropping the mug, which shatters on the floor. Instantly, the back door swings open and a tall, lanky, pale man is suddenly filling all the space in the kitchen, saying, "I'm so sorry for scaring you. I thought there was nobody home. I'm not an axe murderer. I'm Callum's friend. Although I suppose Callum could be friends with an axe murderer. Who knows?" And while he's talking, he has taken hold of Sophie's wrist and is holding her hand under the cold running water. "Oh, dear, I hope it's not too bad. I probably scarred you for life. And was that mug your favorite?" "I think it's going to be okay." Sophie smiles up at him, and he smiles back. He has a sad, accepting sort of smile, as if he knows life probably isn't going to work out, but he's doing the best he can. "I'm Ed," he says, "and you're Sophie, and I think I knew you a very long time ago. Do you remember me?" And suddenly that mournful smile is so sweetly familiar. "Eddie Ripple," says Sophie. And to her own surprise, she takes her wet, sore hand out from under the tap and stands on her toes so she can throw her arms around his neck. Grace and Callum are making the bed together. He says, "Ed is going to stop by at Sophie's place and see if she wants him to quote on painting it. He thinks he knows her." Grace lifts the mattress and tucks in her side of the sheet. Sophie sent around a big bunch of flowers after the anniversary night, but Grace hasn't seen her yet, and it's odd that she hasn't been around. It's also odd that Callum hasn't mentioned her before now. It seems to Grace that something must have happened between Sophie and Callum that night, and it makes her feel guilty, because whatever it was, Grace made it happen. They were the unwitting puppets in Grace's plan to give away her husband to another woman and step out of her life. Then again, they're not made of wood. They do have their own brains. They didn't have to fall in with Grace's plans quite so willingly. Callum says, "Do you remember how your Aunt Connie thought Ed and Sophie would make a good match?" "Did she?" says Grace. "I don't remember." "Oh, dear. Ed Ripple. Aunt Rose always said she thought Connie's matchmaking skills left a lot to be desired." "I'm sure Sophie will meet somebody herself," says Callum. Grace looks up and meets his eyes on the other side of the bed, and he looks away and pretends to be interested in tucking in the corner of the sheet perfectly. So she's right. Something did happen that night. She wonders what it was. Just a kiss? Surely they didn't sleep together. Where would they have gone? Aunt Connie's house? She imagines Callum kissing Sophie. She'd have to stand up on tippy toes, which would be so adorable. His hand caressing the back of her creamy white neck. When he kisses, he does this thing with his thumb on the back of your neck. A slow, delicate, circular motion, which used to drive Grace into a frenzy of weak-kneed desire when they first started going out. And Sophie, what would she be doing? Saying something funny and cute? Blushing? She probably has kissing techniques of her own. She probably does something really unusual and stylish with her tongue. Grace has no kissing techniques. She just lets Callum kiss her and enjoys herself. Then it hits her. Callum and Sophie probably danced together. Of course they danced together. How could Callum resist dancing with a real live woman instead of a cardboard cutout? She becomes aware of a digging pain, as if someone is poking her in the side. It's jealousy. She wanted Sophie to marry Callum, and now she's jealous at the thought of them dancing together. She lets the feeling take hold of her. It's so much better than that horrendous, dull nothingness. It's a proper human emotion. Real, spiteful human blood is pumping through her veins. She says, "Well, would you look at this nice, freshly made bed?" Callum squishes a pillow into a pillow slip. He looks blankly at the bed and says with endearing uncertainty, "Yeah? Don't you think we should mess it up a bit?" He drops the pillow and has her flat on the bed so fast she's laughing while he's kissing her, his hand on the back of her neck, his tongue in her mouth, and she must have been out of her mind to have thought of giving him away to another woman. "Eddie Ripple," says Sophie. "I haven't seen you for 30 years. Can you believe we're old enough to say, 'I haven't seen you for 30 years?' Did you ever think we'd get this old and still be us?" She is sitting with ice wrapped up in a tea towel held against her hand while Eddie kneels with a dustpan sweeping up the broken cup. He looks up at her with exactly the same green eyes of the little boy who used to sit with her under the tuck shop stairs. The blusher and the twitcher. The outcasts, the spastics, the retards. He says, "I think I thought anything that happened to me after I turned 30 would be sort of irrelevant." His voice is deep, with the slower rhythm of a laconic Australian farmer being interviewed on TV about the drought. Sophie can feel her own voice, her own heartbeat, perceptibly slowing down to match his pace. He sounds like a country boy, and of course she remembers that's what he'd become. His family had moved up to Queensland to live on a farm. Sophie, who only had very vague ideas about what the country meant, had always imagined him going to a one-teacher school in a horse and buggy with girls wearing bonnets, like in Little House on the Prairie. "I missed you when you left," says Sophie, remembering that all of a sudden as well. That first day at school without Eddie by her side had been like the first time she'd travelled to another country on her own. She'd felt simultaneously invisible and overly visible at the same time. She used to go to bed feeling sick about school the next day. She says, "But guess what? Then I got popular, and I didn't miss you at all." "How did you manage that?" "My 11th birthday party was a social coup. We got an in-ground swimming pool, you see, and my dad made this amazing slide into the pool. I became A-list after Dad built that slide. All the girls decided my blushing was cute, and the boys pretended not to notice." "I don't think I missed you," says Ed, considering. And of course, that was the thing about Eddie Ripple. He was always devastatingly honest. "Everything in Queensland was so different. We went to school barefoot. We caught yabbies in the creek at lunchtime. It just felt like I stepped into another world, and you didn't even exist anymore. Like my old bedroom, my old street, the whole state of New South Wales had just vanished. And then, 30 years later, I'm having dinner right here in this house with Callum's family, and they started talking on and on about this girl called Sophie, who blushed. And I thought, how many blushing Sophies can there be in Sydney?" And it all came back. All those conversations under the tuck shop stairs. "I seem to recall discussing existential dilemmas with you, Sophie Honeywell, as well as making up bloodthirsty stories about how we'd get revenge on Bruno and all the kids who were mean to us. Anyway, I kept remembering things while they were all talking about you, and then your ex-boyfriend, Thomas, pulled out a photo. And there you were, all grown up and beautiful. Thank you. Sophie grabs hold of a blush and swiftly slays it. Do you still twitch, Eddie Ripple, seeing as you've opened the door on our disorders? He smiles. Not as often, but if I'm nervous or stressed, it comes back. I don't worry so much about it these days. Sophie says, how do you know Callum? I met him when I moved back to Sydney. I play saxophone in his band. So you were there on the anniversary night? Actually, I think I saw you and thought you looked familiar. Yeah, but I never got a chance to say hello. And then when there was all the disaster with Grace's allergic reaction, I thought I'd leave it for another day. Callum told me you want to repaint this house, so I thought I'd come over and ask if you want me to quote on doing it. So, is that what you do? Paint houses and play the saxophone? I do a bit of this and a bit of that. I paint houses because I write poetry, and I've discovered the only way for me to write a poem is to paint a house. I manage a poem a room. The painting pays a lot better than the poetry. The problem is, I paint slower than the average house painter, so my clients have to be patient. But my quality is outstanding, if I do say so myself. Are you a published poet? Well, yeah. But it hasn't exactly flown to the top of the bestseller lists. I actually think my mother might be responsible for all of my sales. She gives them away to waitresses in coffee shops. What about you? What did you end up becoming? Oh, well, I accidentally became a human resources director for a company that makes lawnmowers, says Sophie. Hey, did you know that our old nemesis Bruno is married with twins and working as a chartered accountant for one of the big six firms? I had a 2-week fling with him. Really? Remember Gary Lokovich? I always thought he'd become a hairdresser. Eddie gives her a puckish grin. You are right, he says. He did become a hairdresser. And I had a fling with him. It seems Sophie's fairy godmother has made just a slight error of judgment. It doesn't matter how perfectly the glass slipper slides onto her tiny foot. Prince Charming isn't looking for a princess. Enigma and Rose, Margie and Laura are having a meeting at Rose's house to decide what to do about the Alice and Jack business, now that Rose has gone public. Ever since they issued their media release, the phone has been ringing endlessly. Margie has organised for the Alice and Jack business to give a very big donation to some charity group. An overly generous one, Enigma thinks, but she's keeping her mouth shut. As a public apology. Margie also has some idea about offering the Alice and Jack house as a free place to stay for families with sick children or mothers suffering from postnatal depression, which everybody is excited about. And although it's awful to think of the house being changed after all this time, Enigma quite likes the idea of having nice, grateful people staying there. It gives her a pleasant, kind-hearted feeling. Apparently some silly legal organisation called the Australian Consumer and Competition something or other wants to talk to them about misleading and deceptive conduct, which is very bad, according to Ron, and just goes to show that Rose has got them into hot water. Fortunately, Ron seems to be dealing with lawyers and talking to a lot of serious-looking chaps in dark suits, and they are working out something called a loophole, which sounds like a good idea. Anyway, it's nice for Ron to have something to do and to feel important, so they all act interested and encouraging when he talks about it. Of course, nobody wants to interview Enigma anymore. Oh, no. She's no longer the mystery Munro baby. She's a nobody. She'll never be on This Is Your Life now. She'll never have another Women's Weekly spread, and nobody will ever want her autographed photo. She's just an ordinary old widow who isn't even very good at tennis. She may as well be dead. Is Rose talking to another journalist? Asks Laura. Oh, probably, says Enigma. She's probably there right now telling the whole world that I'm illegitimate, that I'm the daughter of a rapist with a head shaped like an egg. Why does she have to say that part? What's that got to do with anything? Everybody is probably looking at me, thinking my head is egg-shaped. There's no need to snort like that, Laura. It's very bad-mannered. Well, Laura, I blame you for this whole debacle. It is your awful friend's fault. He started it. I said from the beginning he was a kook, but I didn't know he was my own daughter's beau. People are very upset about this, you know, very upset. Did Rose think of that before she started blabbering on? I can see you giggling, Margie. Why are you so happy these days? Enigma feels all itchy with irritation. Nobody is giving her any sympathy whatsoever. You look like the cat that swallowed the cream. I think it's because she stopped swallowing cream, says Laura. Oh, ha-ha, says Margie happily. You're just jealous. I'm nearly as skinny as you. Well, I think actually you're in much better shape than me, says Laura. You're very toned, I must say. I was admiring the back of your arms before. They're called triceps, says Margie. I can do tricep push-ups on my toes. Rose comes back into the room, another one who looks like the cat who swallowed the cream, with her sophisticated new haircut. She's still so pretty, really, and it gives Enigma that jealous, hurt, proud feeling she'd forgotten. When she'd learned that Rose was her mother, she'd thought, I have a beautiful mother, so maybe I'm beautiful too. But nobody who knew the truth had ever commented about Enigma's resemblance to Rose. Daughters were meant to be prettier than their mothers, but Enigma knew, deep down in her heart, that she could never, ever be as lovely as Rose. Enigma probably resembled her father. A rapist. It wasn't fair. Her blood was dirty. Enigma hated her father for what he'd done to Rose. A secret, powerful hatred that could make her feel quite dizzy. Rose says, sorry about that. Another journalist. Oh, Enigma, I forgot to tell you that some young girl called from Channel 9 this morning and asked if you and I would be prepared to be interviewed by Ray Martin. I said, I certainly didn't want to be on TV, thanks very much, but I'd check with you. Enigma nearly spills her cup of tea. Well, Rose, of course I'd like to be on TV. It would be a good opportunity to set the record straight. Television! She'd get her hair and makeup done by a professional. She'd have a tiny microphone pinned to her jacket. Ray Martin would look at her with those kindly interested eyes and ask her questions. All the tennis girls would videotape it. Rose says, I said I was fairly sure you'd be interested. And Enigma catches her winking at Laura and Margie, but she doesn't care, because she's going to be on television, finally. Sophie and Ed are in the living room talking about the colour duck egg blue, which Ed thinks might be perfect to lighten the room, when Sophie says irrelevantly, "Are you single, Ed?" And there's the twitch, a lightning quick spasm of all his facial features, as though an invisible hand suddenly slapped him across the face. The twitch hasn't changed at all, except that it only happens once, and it's so fast that you're not quite sure if you imagined it. He says, "I had my heart pulverized about 2 years ago, and I know it's hard to believe with these devastating good looks, but I've been single ever since." "What about you?" She says, "I haven't been in a relationship since I broke up with Thomas 3 years ago." "It's difficult sometimes being single," says Ed reflectively. And Sophie remembers the scientific way he would examine his own feelings when the boys at school used to do horrendous imitations of his twitch. "Most of the time I'm fine, just getting along with my life. But sometimes I just get hit by this sulky left-out feeling. Like when you played musical chairs and the music stopped and you were there feeling like a moron. You know what I mean?" "Oh, I know," says Sophie. "I know." She watches Ed stopping to examine the framed photos that line the mantelpiece of Connie's old fireplace. "That's my collection of godchildren," she says. "I've got 9 of them. I'm considering telling my friends there are no new vacancies." Ed says, "I've only got one, a friend's daughter called Sarah. She's a little princess. Her mum and dad and I all have to sit around having tea parties with her." He picks up one of the photos and says, "I always assumed I'd be a dad. It's weird. I think I knew I was gay even before I realized what the word meant, but I also had these deeply conservative ideas about how I'd grow up and have kids and live in a house with a white picket fence. I'm sure you could find a nice guy prepared to wear a flowery apron for you," says Sophie flippantly. But then she sees the stoic expression on his face, and it's identical to the one she's felt tightening her own facial muscles when she says to women with false bravado, "Well, my biological clock is sure getting nervous." She watches his profile as he picks up another photo and thinks with a surge of anger on his behalf, "Well, for heaven's sake, why shouldn't Eddie Ripple, sweet, kind, sad Eddie Ripple, be a dad?" She thinks maybe Aunt Connie had it exactly right after all. "Have you got to be somewhere?" asks Ed, as he turns around and finds Sophie looking at her watch. "No," says Sophie. "Just checking the time." Chapter 59. Grace is walking to the top of Kingfisher Lookout. She has the baby in a sling across her front and a backpack full of supplies, from a change of nappy to a sketch pad, just in case Gublet makes an appearance. It's only an hour to the top of the lookout, but it's been like packing for a month-long trekking expedition, and Grace had begun to wonder if it was such a good idea. After all, it would be no problem finding somebody to watch Jake for a couple of hours, especially now that people are treating Grace like she's made of glass. Veronica and Audrey have even offered to take him for a whole night, so that Callum and Grace can go and stay in a hotel and have a romantic dinner together. "I think it's crucial for your relationship," Veronica had lectured. "You need to see yourself as Grace and Callum again, not just in your roles as parents." You have to work to keep the romance alive, you know. It's not like in the early days when everything is just perfect and you can't imagine arguing with the other person or even being annoyed by them.
You mean not like it is for you and Audrey? Grace had teased,
and Veronica grinned her new sheepish grin and said,
"Well, yes, but anyway, love is a decision.
That's what Aunt Connie told me before she died. Actually, I don't really know what her point was, do you?"
Grace hasn't done much exercise since the baby was born. It's a warm spring day, and within a few minutes she can feel sweat trickling down her back. Her heart is thumping, her legs feel heavy and sluggish. The baby is a lumpen weight against her chest, while the backpack thuds uncomfortably against her shoulder blades. And she thinks miserably, "Oh, God, I should just forget it." And then, "Oh, no, no, stop it," because she can feel the swirling blackness ready to suck her down and under, and she's been just managing to hold it at bay for the last few days, mainly through the rediscovery of mind-numbingly good sex. She keeps on walking and thinks about that ridiculous woman yesterday saying piously, "Well, you know what? When I feel down, I just say to myself, 'Megan, every day is a gift.'" If it hadn't been for the girl sitting to Grace's left, who'd caught her eye and pointed discreetly at her mouth, mimicking retching, Grace might have walked out of the Glass Bay postnatal depression support group at that very moment. She had only agreed to go to it to please her mother and Callum. Laura was all for getting Grace straight onto Prozac, while Callum just wanted her to see a good doctor about it. Grace was steadfast. No drugs, no doctors. No drug could make her love her baby like a proper mother. No doctor could magically cure her. Besides which, she was feeling much better. And she didn't have postnatal depression. She'd always been a grumpy, bitchy type of person. That was just her. The very thought of sitting in front of a doctor with all that doctorly focus on her and her inappropriate feelings made her feel unbearably trapped, like a pinned butterfly. But when Callum came home with a yellow flyer pulled from the notice board of the Glass Bay Fish and Chip Shop, she'd agreed to try out the support group. Just once. That was the deal. At least the attention wouldn't be on her alone. Within 10 minutes, she had decided she absolutely wasn't going to a second meeting, especially after pious Megan was followed by a pale, wispy wraith of a woman who'd just had twins and now had 4 children under the age of 5 and a husband in the army who was likely to be shot at any moment in the Middle East. She talked apologetically about how some days she didn't have time to brush her teeth and she felt really down and guilty about not coping. Grace shifted uneasily in her chair, thinking, "Well, of course you can't cope, you poor girl. For God's sake, who in the world could? The government should give her a full-time nanny or something." How could Grace possibly make a comment after that? But then another woman had said, "Well, this is going to sound really bad after what you've been going through, because I've only got 1 baby who sleeps through the night and a very supportive husband. I'm a corporate tax lawyer and have actually always been quite vain about my time management skills. I mean, I could achieve..." But anyway, that's why I don't understand how this has happened. She had taken a deep breath and looked around at the group with a half-fearful, half-laughing expression. "Yesterday, I sat at my kitchen table and stared at a packet of cream cheese for a whole hour."
"Oh."
Grace leaned forward. She hadn't intended to contribute a single word except to compliment the host before she left on her chicken vol-au-vent. Actually quite stodgy. Far too much cheese. But the words were just tumbling out of her mouth. "That happened to me, but it was a carton of milk." Really? Said the woman, and clutched at her arm as if Grace could save her. Did it really? Because I thought I was going quite loony. And then pious Megan interrupted with some inane piece of advice, and Grace sat back and felt teary. She didn't know why it meant so much that a corporate tax lawyer had sat and stared at a packet of cream cheese for over an hour and touched Grace's arm, but it did. And when they talked about their next meeting, Grace had found herself offering to bring along mini quiches, so she guessed she was going again. Their group coordinator had talked about the importance of fresh air and sunshine and exercise. So, seeing as Grace was ignoring all her other advice about antidepressants, counselling and confiding in trusted family members, she had decided that the very least she could do was go for a walk. She tightens the straps of her backpack, takes a deep breath, and forces her body to move. Chapter 60. Do you think if we had a baby together, it would blush and twitch? That's a very strange sort of question. Well, do you think it would? Probably. We'd have to leave it out in the snow to die. Oh, that's a bit sad. Chapter 61. As the path up to Kingfisher Lookout starts to steepen, Grace feels her calf muscles tighten and her breathing get ragged. For God's sake, she and Veronica and Thomas used to run up here without stopping. Veronica always won, of course. At least Jake isn't crying. He's looking around with interest, blinking slightly at the sunshine coming through the trees, a single droplet of saliva hanging off his bottom lip. Grace stops with her hands on her hips to catch her breath and says out loud, "Every day is a gift, Jake. Of course, sometimes it's a really horrible gift that you don't want." "Oh," agrees Jake. Grace wonders if she could ever confide to that corporate tax lawyer that she is devoid of proper motherly feelings for Jake. But as she looks at the soft, flushed curve of his cheek, she is struck with a feeling of loyalty. She won't betray him. He is, after all, markedly more beautiful than the photo the corporate tax lawyer showed of her rather scrawny-looking baby. Also, Callum said he thought Jake might be musical, and Veronica's girlfriend, Audrey, who seems to know a lot about babies, said she thought he was quite advanced for his age. Grace doesn't want anyone feeling pity for Jake. People should feel jealous. "Look," she says to Jake, "you're just stuck with me, okay? I know Sophie might have done a better job, but I'm just going to do the best I can. I'm a better cook than her anyway." Jake chuckles. "Oh, you think that's funny, do you?" She starts walking again. After a while, her breathing gets into a rhythm and her body seems to loosen up and remember the concept of exercise. As she loops around the pathway that Uncle Jimmy and Grandpa built all those years ago, the river glitters and glares in the sunshine, so she has to stop and put her sunglasses on. The jacarandas are out, and their pale, frothy purple is so beautiful against the blue of the sky, it hurts her chest. But perhaps that's just her lack of fitness. She remembers coming up here to paint with Aunt Rose, with her great-grandmother. Would it have made everything different if she'd known that Aunt Rose and Aunt Connie were related to her? Probably not. She still would have taken their love for granted, like children do. Veronica and Thomas have both been going on like disappointed middle-aged parents about the deceit of their family. They are disgusted that everyone has kept the truth from them for all these years, I was perfectly mature enough to handle it at 18, said Veronica, while Thomas was baffled by his family's unethical actions. But Grace quite likes the fact that you can think something is one way all your life, and it turns out you're wrong. It can be something else entirely. It makes her feel free. Nothing is rigid. Things change. You can change your mind. You can change your thinking. Grace is just glad that Alice Munro never existed. Finally, with her heart thudding from exertion, she reaches the top of Kingfisher Lookout and sinks down on her knees at the grassy picnic patch. At least it's a weekday, and there aren't any visitors about to see her bright red face. She lays out a rug from her backpack and unhooks her sling to release poor Jake, who is sweaty from being pressed against her chest. "Are you as thirsty as me?" she asks, as she lays him on the ground. "I've got some nice boiled water for you." "Mmm, delicious, germ-free boiled water." He looks up at her and reaches out a dimpled hand to grab on tight to her hair. As she leans forward, a drop of her own sweat rolls off her forehead and lands on his face. He blinks with surprise. "Sorry," says Grace. "Ha!" says Jake forgivingly, and grins at her. And that's when it happens. And she can hardly believe it, because, oh my God, it is just like all those stupid, mushy new mothers said it would be. A shot of joy straight to the heart, just like the adrenaline that saved her life. A burst of pure, mind-clearing euphoria. Powerful, primal, lustful, blissful love for her son. She presses her lips to the soft, springy skin of his cheek. "Actually, I love you more than anyone," she whispers in his ear. "More than your daddy, even. But that's our secret." Jake grabs her hair tighter and gurgles contentedly, as if he never doubted it for a moment. Chapter 62. Sophie stands at the doorway of Aunt Connie's house and watches a paint-splattered Eddie Ripple loping up the footpath. He stops at the jasmine-covered archway and turns back to give her a funny, quizzical shrug. He looks very handsome and tall, just like Prince Charming. As he walks off, there is a shriek of manic laughter from the kookaburra, sitting with his normal, self-satisfied expression on the side fence. He is alone, so perhaps things aren't working out so well with his lady friend. He doesn't seem too fussed. Sophie looks thoughtfully at her little finger. There is at least one very faint line there. She's sure of it. "Well, here's how it happened. Your dad and I used to be best friends when we were little, and one day we ran into each other again because he came over to paint my house and write a poem. You know how he does. Anyway, I didn't have a boyfriend at the time, and, well, neither did your dad, but we both wanted a baby very, very much. It was exactly 1:23 on a Saturday when I thought of the idea, but it took me 2 weeks to get the courage up to ask him. Your dad was in the middle of dipping a paintbrush into a tin of duck egg blue paint, and maybe he'd just come up with a perfect line for a poem, I don't know, when I said it. At first, he thought I was out of my mind. He twitched. I blushed. But then he said he'd go away and think about it. And I was pretty sure he was going to say yes. So there," she says to the kookaburra. and she goes inside to ring up Claire and invite her to come over and meet her old friend, Eddie Ripple. She's pretty sure Claire will approve. After that, she's going to read a Regency romance and eat a Turkish delight in the bath. Sometimes a girl has to stop waiting around and come up with her own fairy tale ending. Chapter 63. Hi, it's me, Rick. Hello, Rick. You left me with a festering cold sore. I'm sorry. Can I make it up to you by taking you out on the boat again tomorrow? What happened with your ex-girlfriend? It didn't work out. She went back to her ex-boyfriend. Oh, too bad. So, what do you say? Chapter 64. Hi, it's me, Ian. Hello, Ian. I thought you would have been throwing yourself over rapids in New Zealand by now. They made me partner. It pays better than whitewater rafting, and you don't get so wet and cold. Well, congratulations, partner man. Thanks. Hey, I've got spare theatre tickets for Friday night, if you're interested. Chapter 65. Oh my goodness. My goodness me. I think I will cook. So? Have a bath? Dance a jig? Rose slowly, sinuously unfurls her hands above her head like a flamenco dancer. She feels gloriously pain-free. She has got back her light and free 10-year-old body. It's all thanks to Rick the gardener. When was it? Of course, it was the anniversary night, months ago now, before all the business with the kook and Grace's allergic reaction, when Rose got chatting with Rick while he was preparing his fire-eating equipment. He'd admitted he got terrible stage fright before he performed, and that his hands shook all day thinking about it. He'd noticed Rose rubbing her back and asked if she was okay. And because he'd been so honest with her about his stage fright, Rose told him that sometimes the pain of her rheumatoid arthritis was so bad she wanted to lie on the ground like a 2-year-old and cry. And if she'd been an old dog, it would have been kinder to take her out the back and shoot her. Rick said he knew just the thing to help the pain, and took out a fat, neatly rolled cigarette from his jeans pocket. And Rose asked, "Is this an illegal drug?" And Rick had answered, "Well, yes, sort of, but it was just marijuana, and they let cancer patients smoke it, so why shouldn't she?" She had put it in her jacket pocket and forgotten all about it until tonight, when she was watching TV and saw a fire eater being interviewed, and all of a sudden she remembered and thought, why not? It would be better than having another chocolate biscuit. So she sat at her kitchen table and found a match and lit it up. At first, it had made her cough and splutter and burned the back of her throat. But then she had got the hang of it again. She and Connie had both smoked for years, but they gave it up at Connie's insistence when the Surgeon General released his findings on smoking causing lung cancer in the 70s. "Throw them all out right now," Connie had said, marching over, brandishing the newspaper. Of course, Connie had been the one to get Rose smoking in the first place. "Smoke, don't smoke. Sun-dried tomatoes are far too fashionable for us. Sun-dried tomatoes add quite a nice touch to an omelette. Sun-dried tomatoes are old hat. No, you can't tell your daughter that you're her mother, not until she's 40 and doesn't really need a mother anymore and is too old to make you a homemade Mother's Day card. No, you can't be mother of the bride at your daughter's wedding. No, you can't stand up at Nat's funeral and tell everybody that he was the most wonderful son-in-law you could have hoped to have. No, your granddaughters won't ever call you grandma. This is business now, Rose. This is serious. This is about money. No, you can't tell the world that you're a mother and a grandmother and a great-grandmother, because where would that leave Connie? Not the family matriarch, just an elderly, childless old aunt. Rose inhales deeply and watches the smoke curling from her nostrils like a dragon's. She is 10 years old and she is in big trouble from her mother. For something to do with Connie. Don't you know your big sister adored you from the moment you were born? She'd do anything for you. Anything. She is 25 years old and she has walked in on Connie crying in her kitchen. She says it's because she's chopping onions, but nobody cries so hard from chopping onions that their eyes are all swollen. And finally, Connie says that she'd been a few days late, and she'd allowed herself a glimmer of hope. So stupid of her. She hadn't told anyone, not even Jimmy. And then this morning, well, she just had to bloody well accept it wasn't going to happen, didn't she? And for heaven's sake, don't just sit there, Rose. You may as well chop the carrots. If it wasn't for Connie, they would have taken Enigma away, and she would never have seen her again, and there would have been no Laura and Margie, no Grace and Veronica and Thomas, no Lily, no Jake, no Sophie, no children holding their faces up to be painted, no money for beautiful fabric or Christmas presents for the children or a dishwasher that left the glasses sparkling. Rose breathes in Rick's lovely homegrown marijuana and feels a sweet, melting sensation, as if she's just bitten into a chocolate truffle, as if she is a chocolate truffle. What will she do now? All at once, she knows exactly the right thing to do. She wants to paint. Not face painting. She wants to paint a huge canvas of big, brave splashes of gorgeous color. Grace is right. What's wrong with her? Why doesn't she try some form of art other than face painting? She floats around the kitchen and finds her paint kit. But where will she paint? Where is her easel? She must buy herself an easel. She and her beautiful great-granddaughter Grace will paint together, and while they paint, she'll tell her what she couldn't tell her before. She'll tell her to stop tying herself up in knots, worrying about whether she loves Jake like a proper mother. She'll say that she didn't love Enigma like a proper mother either. She felt nothing at all, not a thing. But then one day it came, a rush of love so powerful, so raging and dangerous, it nearly swept her off her feet. Rose sways slightly, remembering exactly how it had felt that day, how it had come from nowhere, flaring like a gas flame. She frowns and bites her lip. Of course, she won't tell Grace what happened next. It was such a long time ago, and she has never regretted it, not once. But still, she wouldn't want to give Grace nightmares. Not like some of the nightmares Rose has had over the years that have left her weak and sweaty and sick in the stomach. She looks down at the glimmering white tiles of her kitchen floor, paid for by the shadowy, mythical figures of Alice and Jack Munro, who also paid for the nice girl Kerry to come and mop them once a fortnight. The perfect canvas! She takes one of the cushions from the kitchen chairs and puts it down on the floor, so she can kneel on it without hurting her knees. Sensible, says Connie in her head. The paintbrush in her hand feels like it's part of her body, an extra long alien finger. She begins to paint, tentatively at first, and then wildly. Her paintbrush is moving on its own. She lies down and puts the pillow under her stomach and uses it to sort of scoot across the floor as she paints. This is fun. Funny. She imagines her daughter's face, if she were to come in and see her now, lying on her kitchen floor, painting her memories. Enigma would say she had the Alzheimer's for sure. She paints a memory of Enigma when she was a baby and learning to walk. She had such a conceited expression on her little face, as though she were the first person in the universe to crack this walking business. She tottered towards Rose's arms, and Rose said very quietly under her breath so Connie wouldn't hear in the next room, "Come to Mummy. Walk to your Mummy." Enigma has forgiven Rose for going public about Alice and Jack. After the immense glory of her 7-minute television appearance with Ray Martin, she has discovered a new career as a guest speaker. She goes around to senior citizens clubs and rotary clubs and bowling clubs and gives them the inside story on the Munro baby mystery. She likes to wear one of those hands-free microphones so she can walk around the audience, sometimes patting her more handsome fans on the shoulder, or even the head, which they don't seem to mind. She has an appointment book and a new mobile phone, and Rose adores the expression on her face when she speaks to her clients. It's exactly the same as her conceited toddler face. She paints Laura and Margie when they were 10 and 12, showing off their diving skills to her at Sultana Rocks, screaming, "Look at this one, Aunt Rose! We're like swans!" And then diving in with their skinny arms stretched wide. Margie is somewhere in Central Australia at the moment. She emails Thomas photos, which he shows to Rose on his computer. Photos of red rippled landscapes that stretch on forever, and Margie looking relaxed and tanned and in need of a shower, standing in front of a dusty four-wheel drive. It doesn't look like she's coming home any time soon. She made everyone promise not to cook for Ron while she's away, but of course everybody still does. It's hard not to feel sorry for him, moping around, doing projects around the house that Margie asked him to do years ago. Rose turned up the other day with a chili beef casserole to find Thomas there, patiently cooking his father a pepper steak, while Lily crawled around his feet. Meanwhile, Laura has moved back into her house on the island and is studying philosophy at the university. Laura is the least philosophical person that Rose knows, so she's a bit worried she's not going to get very good marks. Laura is also officially dating the kook, and they all have to pretend to have forgotten that the first time they met him, he was trying to blackmail them with an urn full of vacuum cleaner dust. He's a pleasant, chatty sort of fellow, but he does have a gambling problem, apparently, so you have to be careful. The other day there was a discussion about the star of an old movie, and Rose had said to him, "I bet you $10 it was Katharine Hepburn," and was mortified in case he should take her up on the bet and set off his problem again. Rose sits back up on her knees and takes another deep, satisfying puff of the cigarette. She must tell her friend Marie, who also suffers from horribly painful arthritis, about this new solution. She could invite her over for a cup of tea and some marijuana. She lies back down on the floor and paints a memory of the children when they were little. Thomas was 5, Veronica and Grace were 4, and they'd all got very, very dirty playing goodness knows where on the island, and Margie had put them all in a big bubble bath together and Rose helped them make beards and moustaches out of the bubble foam, and their giggles of glee bounced around the bathroom, and Rose had thought, if only we could always keep you this happy just by popping you in a bath. Then again, lately the three of them seemed to be about as happy as adults can be, or at least as these particularly prickly adults can be. Veronica has moved in with her new special friend, and sometimes at family events, Rose has observed her just sitting quietly, not saying a word. Of course, it doesn't last long, but it seems as though Veronica isn't wrestling with her life like it's an out-of-control crocodile anymore. Thomas will always be a worrier, but he and Debbie are worried at the moment about what sort of pavers they should choose for their new in-ground swimming pool. Who would have thought there was so much to say on this subject? And this seems to be a fairly pleasant problem to worry about. And Lily seems to be a good-natured little thing who will keep her parents under control. Rose can tell that Thomas will always be somewhat in love with Sophie, but that's life, isn't it? Sophie seems to have a few different fellows calling on her at the moment, but more often than not she's laughing her head off with that nice tall friend of Callum's, Ed Ripple. Everybody assures Rose that no, they won't be getting married because Ed isn't interested in girls. But as far as Rose can see, he's very interested in Sophie, and he makes her happy. So who knows what's going to happen there? Grace, Callum, and Jake have moved into their beautiful new home in the mountains, and Grace has finished her next goblet book, and Rose can see that it's going to be the most beautiful one yet. And when she went over there for dinner the other night, Grace asked if she'd like to see the dedication. And Rose said yes, of course. And it said, "For Rose, my great-grandmother, for all the world to see." She paints Connie, tall and thin and worried, jabbing away with her stick in the sand as she came up with the idea about Alice and Jack, while Rose lay back and closed her eyes and let her take care of everything. "One day," Connie had said, "we'll be sweet little old ladies, and we'll forget it didn't happen the way we said it did." She paints her mother, before she got sick, in a beautiful silk dress with a bell-shaped skirt and an embroidered neckline, the sort of dress she could never afford to wear, the sort of dress Rose would have bought for her from David Jones in the expensive designer part, if she could have her back for one day, to show her how lovely life can be when you've got enough money. She paints the river, green and still and mysterious, and unrolling into a ribbon of lustrous turquoise crepe de chine. She paints the shoes she was wearing the day she went to visit Mr. Egghead to show him their baby. Connie would have had an absolute fit if she'd known her plan. Rose had told her she would take the baby for a walk around the city while she looked in the shop windows, and Connie had wanted to go to the pictures with Jimmy, so she never knew about Rose's idea to catch a train to his house in Annandale, where Mr. Egghead was at home alone while his wife was out cleaning houses. He'd been retrenched from his job at the department store, and he was unshaven and unsmiling, his trouser braces dangling over his shoulders, a stained white collar. It was a bit of a shock after his dapper appearance at the store. Rose followed him into his unpleasant-smelling kitchen, and he sat back down and kept shoveling spoonfuls of horrible, sludgy porridge into his mouth. And Rose said, "I just wanted you to see your daughter," and held her up under her armpits. Rose had dressed Enigma in her very best outfit, and curled up her hair around her fingertips. The baby gazed around with placid interest, while Mr. Egghead flicked her a sneering glance, snorted, and said with his mouth full, "Bloody ugly thing, isn't she?" Rage hit her knees so hard and so unexpectedly, it was as if she'd been crash-tackled. She put Enigma back into her pram, and then she turned to the messy bench top, and she didn't even look at what she was picking up with both hands until after she'd swung it against the back of his head. It made a loud thwack, and he tipped forward face first into his porridge, and then there was silence, except for the sharp, high hum of a blowfly. "She's a beautiful baby," said Rose to the back of his head. She'd put the breadboard back down and pushed the pram out onto the street and caught the train back into the city and met Jimmy and Connie after their movie and said she and the baby had had a lovely time walking around the city. And in all the years to come, whenever people talked about the breadboard murder mystery, all Rose could hear was the hum of that fly. She very carefully paints a fractured egg, dripping blood. It takes up one whole tile. Finally, she puts down her paintbrush and gets to her feet and stands with her hands on her hips, looking at her life and her family spread across the kitchen floor. Before she finds the mop and washes it all away, while she steadily eats her way through an entire packet of chocolate biscuits. The next day, when Sophie comes to visit with an invitation to her 40th birthday party, there is a sweet smell in the air that Rose explains must be the nutmeg in her sponge cake. The floor is white and pure, and Rose looks just like a dear little old lady whose only secrets are recipes. Belinda hopes you enjoyed the reading of The Last Anniversary, written by Leanne Moriarty and read by Caroline Lee. Acknowledgements. A special thank you to my friends Petronella McGovern, Marissa Medina, and Vanessa Proctor for the time they spent reading and commenting on drafts of this novel. I'm also in debt to my sisters, Nicola and Jacqueline Moriarty, for all their suggestions and wonderful encouragement. My grandma, Lily Dennett, provided lots of helpful information about the Depression, and my parents, Diane and Bernie Moriarty, helped with research and ideas and excursions on the Hawkesbury River. Thank you to my agent, Fiona Inglis, for being such a great supporter of my writing career. Finally, I am so lucky and grateful to have Kate Patterson as my publisher and editor. She made it a much better book. Our audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular among travellers, families, and people who are on the go. If you really enjoyed this audiobook, please introduce your friends and family to the experience. We're sure they'll love you for it. If you want to hear more about our fabulous range of titles, please visit us online at belinda.com. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.